Hey, everybody, what the fuck's going on? This episode of the podcast is brought to you by Diff Eyewear. Diff Eyewear, they offer stylish, handmade sunglasses constructed with high-end materials. They're as good or better than designer sunglasses without the $200 or $300 price tags. Instead, Diff sunglasses start at just $50 a pair. And the best part is, for every pair of sunglasses you buy, Diff, that's D-I-F-F, Eyewear, will give a pair of reading glasses to someone in need. And these are excellent glasses, and I wear them. One of the reasons I wear them, they have those old-school cop aviator ones with the mirrors. Those are fucking hard to get. It's hard to get a good quality old-school mirrored sunglasses, goddammit. No, people don't want to look like a creeper. Not me. I relish it. I like looking like a fucking creeper with the mirrored sunglasses. Why? What is wrong? Does everybody have to know what you're looking at? You know? Why is mirror bad? You don't want to look at yourself? I like them. Anyway, excellent sunglasses. And you can get one in pretty much any color you like and still pay less than some designer brands. They're excellent. I really enjoy them. Very high quality. I wear them all the time. If you see me, you go, hey, man, is that Diff Eyewear? Probably, bitch. What's with the questions? Anyway, do good, buy smarter, be Diff. Go to Diff Eyewear, D-I-F-F, eyewear.com/Rogan right now to get 15% off your purchase. That's diffeyewear.com/Rogan for 15% off. diffeyewear.com/Rogan. We are also brought to you by Casper. This podcast is supported by Casper, an online retailer of premium mattresses for a fraction of the price. And our very own young Jamie has one of these mattresses. They installed it in his house, and he fucking raves about it. He loves it. He said it is the best mattress that he's ever had, and they are shockingly, ridiculously low-priced in comparison to premium mattresses made by other brands. Why is that? Because they've done the wise thing. What they've done is they have cut out the middleman and done what so many companies are doing now. They make really high quality stuff and they sell it to you directly online. These mattresses are made in America, very high quality, and they have a risk-free trial and return policy. I really like this. You don't have to worry about it. Try it for a full 100 days with free delivery to the US and Canada and painless returns. What more do you want? You can't go wrong there, folks. Pricing is $500 for twin side mattresses and $950 for a king size mattress. Now, if you go to a premium mattress store and compare those, I guarantee you are not going to find the same quality for anything close to that kind of price. So go try. Check it out. And look, you can't go wrong if you want to try this. You get to try it for a fucking 100 days. Come on, folks. And there's a special offer for listeners of this podcast. You can get $50 towards any mattresses by visiting www. Why do they have to put www? Everybody knows that. Casper.com/Joe and using the promo code Joe at checkout. Terms and conditions apply. But again, this is an awesome mattress. It's an awesome deal, an easy return policy, and an awesome guarantee. Risk-free trial and return. Casper.com/Joe. Use the promo code Joe at checkout to save yourself $50. And we are also brought to you each and every episode by Onnit.com. Go to O-N-N-I-T. Use the code word Rogan and you will save 10% off any of our amazing supplements like Alpha Brain, Shroom Tech Sport, New Mood, things that John Dudley and I talked about in this very podcast. That's who's my guest, you fucks. Onnit.com, O-N-N-I-T. Again, use the code word Rogan. Check out the Onnit Academy link because it is filled with hundreds of pages of awesome articles on exercise physiology, strength and conditioning routines, different diets, the science of nutrition. John's flexing right now in front of me. It's also an awesome gym in Austin, Texas, the actual physical Onnit Academy. Great state-of-the-art workout facility with great instruction and 10th Planet Jiu-Jitsu. Go to Onnit.com. Get on it. You know you want to. God damn it. Get your fucking shit together and get on it. Onnit.com. And that's it. My guest today is my good friend, my archery guru, and my hunting buddy, John motherfucking Dudley. And we are in Iowa, ladies and gentlemen. We are we're Dudleying it up, and we're talking. We did an impromptu podcast, so I'm let you guys have it. So here we go. Without any further ado, ladies and gentlemen, the great John Dudley.
Joe Rogan Podcast. Check it out.
The Joe Rogan Experience.
Train by day, Joe Rogan Podcast by night, all day.
Coming at you live from Iowa, deep, deep, deep in the Midwest. That's where we are, right? I don't know where that came from.
Really, Jamaican.
It was inspired by the lack of diversity in this town. A lot of white people out here, folks. White people and corn. You know that term, corn-fed? That was created
in Iowa. Yeah, for sure.
It was. I'm having a great time out here, John Dudley. I've been out here with my pal John Dudley and getting some archery coaching and doing a lot of bow hunting. And we're seeing a lot of deer, man. Iowa's like made out of deer and corn.
Deer, corn, and beans.
And white people.
Yep.
But it's awesome. The deer out here are incredible. I mean, I've never seen so many white-tailed deer in my life. Definitely. Never seen. We've hunted for 3 days. So far, unsuccessfully, but had a great time. Saw a lot of deer. And today, at least, had a couple pretty close opportunities. Just, you know, if you don't know anything about bow hunting, you have to be a certain distance from the animal. You have to have a certain kind of shot. It's not like a rifle. With a rifle, an animal can be 300 yards away. All you need is a steady rest and a good rifle, and that's a dead deer. But with bow hunting...
This episode is brought to you by ZipRecruiter. If you're looking for something to do this summer, you might want to check out some of the upcoming fights. Even better, if you can catch them up close in person. It's quite an experience. But if you want to get the best seats, you have to act fast. And that's true for a lot of things in life, especially when it comes to hiring for your business. You need to hire the most talented people you can before the competition scoops them up. And to do that, you need ZipRecruiter. And luckily, you can try it for free at ZipRecruiter.com/Rogan. Got your eye on a rock star candidate? ZipRecruiter's invite to apply feature lets you cut the line. Once you review ZipRecruiter's list of the most qualified candidates for your job, you can easily invite your top choices to apply to encourage them to apply sooner. So, amp up your hiring performance with ZipRecruiter and find the best fast. See why 4 out of 5 employers who post on ZipRecruiter get a quality candidate within the first day. Just go to ZipRecruiter.com/Rogan to try it for free right now. Again, that's ZipRecruiter.com/Rogan. ZipRecruiter, the smartest way to hire. This episode is brought to you by MeUndies. For most of the year, fancy underwear technology sounds unnecessary. Breathable, quick dry, moisture wicking, anti-odor. It's a bit overkill, right? But then summer hits and the heat comes. Suddenly, all that sounds pretty damn essential. Be prepared for summer like me with MeUndies. So far, I love the items that I've gotten from them. They're all soft, comfortable, and flattering. I recommend it hands down, and don't worry, MeUndies has a cut for every guy with over 10 different styles, ranging from boxer briefs to jock straps to the new and improved ball caddy. Plus, they come in over 100 different colors and prints, ranging from black to all over sharks. No matter what pair you get, it'll have MeUndies' signature super soft micro-modal fabric. It is amazing. So everything is breathable, stretchy, and oh so comfy. They also offer some of the most summer-proof fabric. So breathe. It's perfect for working out or just keeping you cool on those really hot days. And if you're not happy with your first pair of underwear, it's on MeUndies. Summer is coming. Be prepared with my favorite underwear, MeUndies. Comfort for the outside in. Get 20% off your first order, plus free shipping at MeUndies.com/Rogan. That's MeUndies.com/Rogan. Tap the banner to learn more.
No, you know, you really ideally want to be inside of 40 yards if you're, you know, if you can. But what we're seeing is these big, giant, mature, wild, 250, 300-pound mammals that are running around here. They're these, you don't think of them that way, but when you're around them, like when you drive down the road, you're like, oh, look, there's a deer. But when you're hunting them and you make eye contact with these things, you kind of, it changes the nature of what they are to you. Like, let's talk about that, the experience that we had. Was it on the first day or the second day? The first day, we had a couple encounters, then we decided to come down off of the stand, and I decided. We said 1:30 or 1:40, we said we were going to stop.
I personally said 1:30, and then at 1:25, you said, dude, let's bail.
So this is how that always goes. At 1:25, we had been in the stand since 6:30 in the morning. At 1:25, I got down, and as I'm getting my stuff, we climb all the way down from this tree. John puts his thumb on either side of his head like Bullwinkle to make the classic sign of deer antlers, and this big old honking deer is coming down the way. And first, a little deer came by and got within 15 feet of me?
I was going to say 10 feet.
It might be 10 feet of me. I was standing by this tree. Obviously, I'm in all camo, and I'm not moving. I'm just freezing. And young deer and old deer, they might as well be a different species.
Yeah, I think they are.
They don't look the same.
Just with the same hair.
They don't look the same, and they definitely don't look at you the same. So one young deer walked by me, didn't notice me at all. He was like within easily inside of 10 feet. And then the second deer walked by. He was inside of like 25, 30 yards, walked right by me. But then this mature deer came by, and his color was different, and he spotted me immediately. And he looked at me with this crazed intensity in his eyes. And it's so interesting because right away I go, oh, that's why people love to hunt these things. Look how smart that thing is.
Yeah.
It's just looking at me. I mean, I was frozen solid. I wasn't moving at all. And I was looking at him, and he was looking at me, and his eyes were wide like dinner plates. He knew exactly what I was. And he was like, fuck this. And he just turned around and bolted. But it was the electricity in the air and the intensity of his recognition of me. It was so obvious. And I remember thinking immediately, wow, this is a really intelligent, tuned-in animal that knows what a person is. They know people equals hunting. People that are out.
Danger.
You know, danger. They equal danger. Where the young ones don't have any idea. I took some pictures, and I'll post a picture up on Instagram. We were sitting in the same stand the second day, and this young deer came by and literally took a nap underneath us.
Oh, that's right. I forgot about that.
Not only did he not know we were there, like, he didn't give a shit. He just laid down. He's a year-old buck. His mom is out being a hoe. She's out getting gangbanged because they're in the middle of what they call the rut. And if you're a non-wildlife enthusiast, the rut is one time a year. And it's kind of a crazy thing if you think about it. One time a year, they have sex. So the entire year, everything's normal, everybody's buddy-buddy, and then all of a sudden, one time out of the year, for how long does it last?
I would say 3 weeks intensely. Three weeks.
For 3 weeks, they lose their fucking minds. They lose weight. They can't think straight.
No.
They run out into traffic. They get hit by cars. And they're literally just boner crazy. They have no idea what's going on, and they go bananas.
Well, so, I sent you a text. I said, these poor suckers, for 340 days a year, you can't even find one. But then all of a sudden, they go full retard.
Yeah. Imagine that was the case with people. Imagine if you were like a normal person, and then one time out of the year, you start growing a sword out of the top of your head, and and you just get crazy.
Your neck swells up as big around as your waist.
I mean, for people who don't know, they lose those antlers. A lot of people don't even know that. that don't pay attention to deer, but deer grow antlers fresh every year, and then once they're done having sex and they're done with the rut, those antlers get weak and they just fall off, which is what a bizarre metamorphosis as an animal.
Actually, how horn grows is fascinating to me.
It's incredibly fascinating.
If you shoot a deer that's still in velvet, and then you're holding that velvet, and you have to, in order to preserve
Explain velvet.
So velvet's like when it's fuzzy, like velvet, on the horn, when it's in the growing phase, before it actually hardens, it's fuzzy, like, you know, just like velvet or fleece. And then what happens is that'll start to, their hormones start to change and their horns start to harden, and then they rub the velvet off so that it's just pure hard bone. And it's really interesting that
it's not bone, right? It's like a, it's like fingernail type material, right? It's,
I don't know, man. What is it? It's harder than my fingernails.
Maybe yours, bro.
Yeah, well, yeah, maybe yours are super hard. Like, but.
No, but what is it made out of? Why don't you Google it? Can you Google it? Will you have a computer in front of you?
Yeah, we'll Google it.
It is a, they are really fascinating animals. I mean, I'm a wildlife enthusiast. I've always been really into wildlife. I've always been fascinated by wolves and lions and predators and all kinds of weird birds and stuff. I've always been drawn to like nature shows and things along those lines, but it's massively intensified since I started hunting. Let's see what we have here.
This says the horns of a rhinoceros are made of keratin.
Yeah, that's the same stuff as fingernails.
Yep, and grow continuously.
Well, just Google antlers instead of horns. Because what are you? You're a goddamn... Yeah, what are antlers made of? It was like the second... You're a goddamn...
listen, Jamie's not here right now.
You're a professional bow hunter. How the hell do you call them horns? Antlers, son.
Are they antlers?
Deer antlers are made of true bone that is fed by the covering of velvet. Wow, you're right. Antlers are made of true bone. Well, you're right all the time. Antlers are made of true bone that is fed by blood, which is carried to the outer velvet covering. Velvet antlers are hot to the touch with brushy hair and a waxy feeling coating. Deer need both protein and minerals to grow their antlers.
And that's what I'm saying. Yeah. There's actually blood in them. If you shoot a buck in velvet, you actually have to inject the velvet with embalming fluid so that they don't, like, you know, in order to preserve them. But it's amazing that you have to find the vein in the horn and you push the embalming fluid through and it actually flushes and the blood comes out the base of the horn.
How do you find the vein?
There's one vein that runs the entire length of the main beam and there's one that runs from each tine. It's really strange.
I shot a velvet buck in Colorado last year, and it's on my desk in my studio. And they said, how do you want to take care of it? Like when I was getting it treated, because I get all my the heads done what's called European mount style. The European mount style is like if you see a mounted head on someone's wall with the skin and the fur on it, and then they have fake eyeballs and the fake nose. That's like traditionally what you see. I find that offensive. I know that's a doll. I'm looking at a doll pretending to be the deer I shot. There's a foam thing under there. It's got fake eyes. I know it's fake. But if you see the skull, like that's a real skull.
A radish patch buck?
That buck is awesome. That is a massive buck. Is that the one that you shot on your show in Colorado or in Wyoming?
Montana.
Mm-hmm. Montana, because it wasn't lighted Knox, right? You couldn't use
right.
lighted
Knox. Yeah.
So I told them, they go, what do you want to do with the velvet? And I said, does it scrape off? They were like offended. They're like, what? You want to scrape it off? I was like, there's antler under there, right? I go, well, do whatever you want to do. Just let me know. And they
do that in Europe. In Europe, if the Danish shoot a buck, and I've been on a few hunts with Danish people and they'll shoot a buck. And if it's in full velvet, they strip it all off right away because it's not like – it's almost like I think they feel like they shot an adolescent even though it's in a fully matured – because by the time season opens, that velvet is on the verge of being rubbed off.
Right.
The horn is fully matured, but it just hasn't come off. So,
but that's Denmark, right? They don't know any better. It's like they're – They're barely developed.
I don't know. They know.
Dude, they're just out of the caves. Just got out of the caves there a couple weeks ago. If you're listening from Denmark, we're kidding, folks. We've been up since 6 o'clock in the morning.
Five.
That's right.
I was up at 4:30. I got up at 5. Hot tubbing.
Whoa, he was hot tubbing. Not with me. I'll tell you that.
Well,
no hot tub with dudes. I got up at 5, but anyway, we're out the door at 5:30. So we've been up for a long time. That's the point. Right now it is almost 10 p.m., and we got to do it again tomorrow. Tomorrow's the last day of this fantabulous hunt here in the great Midwest state of Iowa.
Well, Iowa, what do you think of Iowa hunting?
Awesome. Amazing. What's the tradition here? And it's obvious. You know, when you talk to all the folks, the locals, our friend Craig, who is the local game warden, you know, gives us all the details on all that's going down. Your neighbor shot a giant. Good Lord.
I know.
Oh, my God. He shot a monster animal.
He's on the uppity up. But, no, what I really appreciate about Iowa is they have a great program, too. And you haven't got to experience it yet because we haven't got to go to the meat locker. But Iowa has a program called the Hush. And it's pretty much hunters feeding the hungry is really what it is. It's a great program to where people are allowed to shoot extra deer tags in order to, and they can donate that to a Hunters for the Hungry program. So they actually feed, like it goes to homeless shelters and things like that. And it's a necessity, like I told you. In my county here, I believe the number of antlerless deer that have to be taken is like 4,200 extra tags.
And just you've to keep the population balanced.
Right. Well, you've seen how many times have we had to slow the truck down to not hit a deer, and you've been here 3 days.
Quite a few. The sheer population numbers are pretty incredible. And one of the reasons for it is that they've done a really good job of making sure there's not overhunting. They also regulate the type of hunting you can do, where mostly it's bow hunting in Iowa. Uh-huh. But you can shotgun hunt, but you can only shotgun hunt for a few days a year. And by the way, I'd rather have a bow than a shotgun. You can make a longer shot with a bow than you can with a shotgun, and a more efficient shot with a bow than you can with a shotgun.
I just feel like you get to enjoy more of nature.
You don't blow your ears out either.
Yeah, what?
What?
That's an inside joke.
There's a lot of people with blown ears from guns, folks.
Mine are ringing right now.
Yeah, cams ring all the time, too.
They do?
Yep. I know a lot of guys who have been hunters their whole life who have really bad ear problems. Ranella has ear problems.
Is Cam as deaf as I am?
Not quite as deaf as you are, but he's got ringing problems. He's got issues.
Yeah.
And it's, again, from shooting firearms when he's young without ear protection. I wear ear protection every time I fire a gun. Every time.
That's smart. Yeah, mine ring. I was never told otherwise.
Except this last time I shot that elk. I shot that elk with no ear protection. But
were they ringing then?
No. Just one shot.
You're too tough for your ears to ring.
That's very kind of you, but not true. Does anybody have tough ears? No, yeah, bro, my ears are tough. Go ahead, scream in my ears, bro.
I don't know.
I tighten them up.
I've seen some cauliflower ear in the UFC. There's no sound penetrating those suckers.
Yeah, well, it's not good sound. People always ask me why I don't have cauliflower ears. I wear ear guards. I've always worn ear guards. For 20 years, I wore ear guards. I have a little tiny bit of cauliflower ear, like you can feel it here. What cauliflower is, if you don't know, is when your ears get bent over or broken. It doesn't have to happen from wrestling. It can happen. Sometimes boxers get it. You can get it if somebody hits your ear. If something hits your ear, what it is basically just bleeding. And when it swells up with blood, when blood sits there and pools up, when it heals, it calcifies. And so it literally becomes a rock.
Yep.
Like Randy Couture used to drive his cauliflower ear into his opponent's eyeballs. Because it's like a rock. So he's he's taking guys down and like he's clinching with them and he's shoving his ear into their eye socket and using it as a weapon to drive them down. But good luck getting some fucking iPod earbuds into those things, man. You can't.
That's not happening.
You can't hear good either. Like, take your ears, folks. If you're listening at home, take your ears and then take the top and do this. Fold them down like that. And then hear how different everything sounds. And then let them go. Your ear's designed a very specific way. And that way is to catch the sound waves. The sound waves come in. It resonates off of the shape of your ear, and it goes into the hole. These guys that I know a ton of guys whose ears are so fucked up they can't get earbuds in. They have to wear over-the-ear earbuds. Oh, it's super common. It's really, really common.
It's probably why they always have the big over-the-ear Beats by Dre.
Yeah.
Just so they can...
Sponsors.
Oh, okay. Sponsor stuff.
They sponsor the UFC.
Okay.
But, yeah, but... It's hard for them to get earbuds in. They're not going to fit.
They're not getting an earbud.
I don't know how we got into earbuds. Well, we started with Iowa. How do we go with this?
It doesn't matter.
It doesn't matter. But
we saw Caitlyn Jenner's nipple.
Things you can't unsee for 100.
Right there. I'm going to take it. I'm going to spin this thing right around.
Alex, I'm going to go with things you can't unsee. Yeah. All of a sudden they're big. Caitlyn has big boobs. I want to point out the political correctness of all the people in your hunting camp because everybody referred to her as a she.
Yeah.
Really?
I didn't. We have one of my buddies came and one of his buddies played golf.
Yeah.
Did a charity outing and then had a picture. And it was, they were surprised that there was such a transformation.
There's a surprise. Surprise!
Yep.
There was a lot going on.
Well, what do you think about this fight card? Got a fox fight tomorrow night.
Yeah, we're going to come back and watch the fights after I kill a monster buck. It's on the books, folks. It's in the cards. I'm making a prediction. It's a big fight. The main event is huge. It's Rafael Dos Anjos, who's the former UFC lightweight champ, versus Tony Ferguson, who is undoubtedly, without question, one of the best lightweights in the world. And a guy who's been knocking on the door to a title shot for a while. It's a really interesting fight because it highlights a real issue with MMA right now. And that issue is weight cutting. Rafael Dos Anjos had a terrible weight cut for the Eddie Alvarez fight. I'm hearing a lot of like conflicting stories, but all of them really bad. Now, I shouldn't say conflicting. I should say different stories, but of what went on when he was making weight for his fight with Eddie Alvarez. And apparently he was in bad shape, like really bad shape, like barely made weight for that and was, you know, just really in physical discomfort and pain and just all screwed up from that weight cut. I think weight cutting is one of the worst aspects of fighting. I think it might be worse than the beatings these guys take. We don't see it visually. We don't see cuts in their face. We don't see knockouts. We don't see blood when they're cutting weight. So we don't think of it as the same kind of damage that we do from a beating. But I think it might be as bad, if not worse.
I would say worse.
It could very well be. And then even more worse is the fact these guys are dehydrating themselves literally to death's door and then fighting. Train killers 24 hours later.
Yeah.
It's unavoidable. It's unnecessary. I mean, it's not unavoidable. It's avoidable, it's unnecessary, and it's foolish. I think it's one of the most foolish aspects of the sport. And, you know, we were talking today with some of the guys at your camp about, like, issues with MMA and what the new owners are going to do now that the UFC has been purchased. And I hope they institute a program to eliminate weight cutting. I think it is one of the biggest problems. And it's a time bomb, and it's just waiting to go off in everybody's face.
Yep.
And a guy like Rafael Dos Anjos, who's one of the elite of the elite, before he lost to Eddie Alvarez, a lot of people, including me, were making the argument that he might be the best lightweight ever. You look at it, he knocked out Benson Henderson. He beat the shit out of Nate Diaz. He knocked out Cowboy Cerrone in one round. He's a fucking monster. I mean, he's a killer. He beat the shit out of Anthony Pettis for 5 rounds to win the title. Just rolled him over. Just beat him down. You can make the argument he's one of the greatest, certainly one of the greatest lightweights of all time. Might be the best in terms of, like, champions. And the guy was so depleted from his weight cut that he was like, I'd heard he was passing out backstage. You know, I just, if that guy died, let's imagine, I mean, God forbid, right? But let's imagine if a guy like that dies because of a weight cut, and it has happened. The last death in MMA was in Brazil, and it was from a fighter who cut weight. He died from weight cutting. He didn't die from the fight itself. I think it's a terrible thing that can be eliminated. And I think that if we did, you would see better fights.
That's what I'm saying.
Yeah.
Someone like that's having to cut that much, mm-hmm. are you really seeing them at their best?
You absolutely are not. There's no question about it.
See, I think Cowboy looks way better when he's fighting heavier.
Much better. Look how good he looks at 170.
I think that's it.
He's always been an elite fighter, even at 55, but at 170, he looks like a world champion.
Exactly. Yeah, I'm waiting to see a title contention right there that weight.
I think it's an old thing.
We were talking today about Cyborg.
Yeah.
Because you were telling me what she walks around at.
175. Yeah. She's
it's like way how, too big. And I said, well, as jacked as she is, how does she cut that much? I mean, that seems like an impossibility.
She does it. It's sheer strength of will. George Lockhart, who's her coach, who's a really, really high-level nutritionist and weight-cutting expert, and he gets her down to that weight. But it's not pretty. You know, there's a video of her struggling to make 140. The weight classes in the UFC for women, as of right now, there's only two. There is 115, and then there's 135. And they've experimented with 125. They talked about doing 125-pound weight classes, like a title at 125. But as of yet, it doesn't exist. But I think, honestly, Cyborg has said that really her best weight class isn't even 45, which she's a champion of in Invicta. Her best weight class would be 55.
Yeah, I would say.
Yeah. And there's other girls out there, man. Build it and they will come. You know,
I think 55 would be a really good women's class because you'd almost have that like Mark Hunt, Brock Lesnar style. You'd get some real just powerhouses in there that are still not too big where they're out of shape, but they could just, I mean, they could be like Cyborg. I think if you built it, you'd have people coming from other countries that you probably don't even know about.
I think you certainly would after a few years. And that's just an investment that I think they have to make with women's MMA right now. Women's MMA is where men's MMA was when the UFC was first purchased. Because a lot of people don't realize, but when the UFC bought when they purchased it from the old owners, they eliminated the 155-pound weight class because they used to have a 155, then they had a 170, and then they had, I think they had a middleweight and a light heavyweight and a heavyweight still. But they didn't have anything lower than 170. So a lot of guys either left the UFC to fight in other organizations or they moved up to 170 and competed at 170. And some guys were like really oversized or undersized for that weight class. So that's not enough, obviously. I mean, it's really important that for a guy like Mighty Mouse, like if there wasn't a 125-pound weight class, which where Mighty Mouse competes, we wouldn't be able to see the best fighter of all time compete in his perfect weight class. Or 135. You know, you wouldn't be able to see Dominic Cruz compete at his optimal weight class, 145. You wouldn't be able to see Jose Aldo go on that reign of terror for all those years. You wouldn't be able to see Conor McGregor fight at 145 and beat Aldo. And then 55 for the long time. 55, which is one of the most competitive and talent-rich divisions in the UFC, didn't even exist. And, you know, so I think that the UFC, if they really want to make that commitment for women's MMA, they should have a full range of weight classes for those girls to compete at. I think they should start maybe even lower than 115. I mean, you could make a real strong argument for a 105-pound women's class, a 105, a 115, a 125. And then I think really the trend of those 10-pound per weight class, that should exist in the men's division as well. There's too big, the gaps in the men's divisions are way too big. There's 170, and then there's 15 pounds higher, 185. That's a big jump. And then there's 20 pounds above that, 85 to 205, 20 pounds. Think about taking 20 16-ounce T-bone steaks. And that's how much bigger that guy is than the guy before him. Then you go 205 to 265. So think about taking 60 T-bone steaks.
Yeah.
6-0 and stacking them up, thinking about all the horsepower that comes with all that weight. It's just, there's too, the gaps are too large.
Yeah.
There's too few weight classes. So I think the UFC would be, it would be very smart for them to make more weight classes, do a weight class every 10 pounds, and eliminate the weight cutting if they could. And I think it can be done. They're probably going to have to get rid of some champions, though. Not get rid of, but they're going to have to move people around.
Reorganize around.
Yeah, yeah, I mean, and the people who are champions, yeah, they're not going to want to do that, you know. You're not going to be able to. It's going to be a hard fight to tell a guy like Dominic Cruz he can't cut weight, you know, when he's the world champion. You say, look, man, what do you weigh? You weigh 155? You're going to have to fight at 155.
Yeah.
What?
It'd be interesting, though, to see how much better fights we'd see.
Yeah.
If people were... I mean, there's obviously going to be a position where people are getting in good shape because there's a lot of fighters now that the testing's happening to where that when they come out, you can tell they're not as noticeably good shape as what they were at one time.
They're not as jacked.
Yeah, they're not as
muscular. Yeah. Yeah.
And it kind of seems like maybe we aren't getting the same class of fighting at times.
With some guys. But the best guys, I don't think that's the case. Guys like Mighty Mouse, I mean, you know, he's still the elite of the elite. You know, you go down to 55, Eddie Alvarez looks sensational at 55. And, you know, he has no issues with it. He looks just as good after the USADA testing as he ever did. Look at Tyron Woodley. Passes like a flying color. And if anybody looks like they're some sort of a science project, it's Tyron Woodley. He's like the best built guy in the UFC. Clean as a whistle. Just awesome genetics and hard training. You know, and then you go up to a 185. Yoel Romero is the king of the freaks. I mean, he's the freakiest freak that ever freaked. I mean, if that guy's not on steroids, you just go, what the fuck? Well, you know, some people just have amazing genetics.
Yeah, those people, they're walking around at their weight they should be in.
Yeah. I think that would help the whole sport. If they could figure out how to do that, if they could figure out how to eliminate the weight cutting and do it smart and do it over, you know, a period of time and figure out a way to establish new champions and new divisions and give guys financial incentives to do this. And just let them know for your own good, for everybody's good. There's nothing wrong with being lean if you want to lose body fat and, you know, and drop down some weight in a natural, healthy way. But this dehydration shit has got to stop.
Yeah.
It's a time bomb. It's a ticking time bomb. And it's waiting to blow up in the face of the most exciting sport in the world. And I just think it's totally avoidable.
And if you're training the way these guys are training, you're losing your excess fat anyway.
Well, if you're eating right. Unfortunately, some guys, like Big Country. Roy Nelson trains like a madman, but he eats like shit. You know, unfortunately, he eats like a madman too. You know, and you can't say that it's just training because Roy's not out of shape. I mean, that sounds crazy to say when you look at him, but he's not out of shape. I mean, if you underestimated his cardio and you go, man, I don't even have to train for this guy, that guy will beat your ass. You know, he's in real good shape, but he just carries too much excess body fat.
It's, well, Aubrey's always talking about how Cowboy likes his candy.
Yeah, but he stopped that.
He did. Yeah, he did say that.
Well, once he started getting into Onnit. He started getting into Onnit supplements, and he started listening to real nutritionists, and he just completely altered his diet, and for the first time in his life started supplementing. And, you know,
Get that off.
No, I got it, man. I'm taking off these boots. I'm wearing these goddamn boots all day.
This episode is brought to you by MeUndies. For most of the year, fancy underwear technology sounds unnecessary. Breathable, quick dry, moisture wicking, anti-odor. It's a bit overkill, right? But then summer hits and the heat comes. Suddenly, all that sounds pretty damn essential. Be prepared for summer like me with MeUndies. So far, I love the items that I've gotten from them. They're all soft, comfortable, and flattering. I recommend it hands down. And don't worry, MeUndies has a cut for every guy with over 10 different styles, ranging from boxer briefs to jock straps to the new and improved ball caddy. Plus, they come in over 100 different colors and prints, ranging from black to all over sharks. No matter what pair you get, it'll have MeUndies' signature super soft micro modal fabric. It is amazing. So everything is breathable, stretchy, and oh so comfy. They also offer some of the most summer-proof fabric, so breathe. It's perfect for working out or just keeping you cool on those really hot days. And if you're not happy with your first pair of underwear, it's on MeUndies. Summer is coming. Be prepared with my favorite underwear, MeUndies. Comfort from the outside in. Get 20% off your first order, plus free shipping at MeUndies.com/Rogan. That's MeUndies.com/Rogan. Tap the banner to learn more. This episode is brought to you by SimpliSafe. Springtime is all about freshness. You got fresh air, fresh starts, freshly cleaned homes. And as you're getting your home in order, it might be a good time to take a fresh look at SimpliSafe home security. I think they're one of the best options out there, and so do a lot of others. SimpliSafe is loved by customers and experts alike. It was even named Best Home Security Systems of 2024 by U.S. News and World Report. And here's why I think you'll like it. The system blankets your whole home in protection. That includes advanced sensors and cameras to help detect break-ins, fires, floods, and more. Plus, with 24/7 professional monitoring, you can rest easy knowing you'll get a fast emergency response when you need it most. Monitoring agents can even help stop crime in real time. SimpliSafe has given many people a real peace of mind. I want you to have it too. So try it out risk-free with no contract and a 60-day money-back guarantee. Get 20% off your system today when you sign up for Fast Protect Monitoring at simplisafe.com/JRE. That's simplisafe.com/JRE. There's no safe like SimpliSafe.
Hey, we haven't done almost, we have done almost nothing, but yet I'm exhausted. That's the irony of this whitetail hunting. He's sitting in a tree stand all day waiting for
mental
deer.
It's totally a mental game.
It is. It is.
And I told you going in.
It's mental, and it's completely, for a guy like me, it takes me completely out of my comfort zone.
I actually took video of you on the second morning. We were about 2 hours in, and I could tell Joe was just like, this is bull crap. Because he's like, wait, we're going to sit here 13 hours? You were doing twisties. You were, like, going side to side, like, twisting. And then you were doing some squat thrusts. You were, like, kind of, like, doing, like, quarter squats. Then you ate a peanut butter and jelly sandwich. Then you, like, drank your coffee. Then you took a leak. And that was all in the first hour and a half.
Just trying to get amped up, bro. I'm prepared, bro.
I was like, okay.
I'm gonna make sure when it goes down. That's the other thing, too. It's like, there's all this time. I mean, think about all the time you practice archery. You know, I practice archery. I try to practice 4 days a week. If I don't practice 4 days a week, I get upset with myself. I'd like to practice every day, but sometimes that doesn't work out. But I can usually get in at least an hour or so 4 days a week. So that's all these weeks and weeks and weeks of practice. And some days, I mean, if I don't have shit to do, I'll practice 3 or 4 hours, yep. You know? And so I'm just shooting arrow after arrow after arrow, waiting for one moment where an animal turns broadside. It's like, it's almost like, it's not as crazy as a fight because there's no physical consequences to me, but it's more crazy in some ways because literally it depends on one execution of one move.
Yep.
The one execution, the release of a perfect arrow, and the concentration and the focus has to be perfect, and you have to launch that arrow whoosh, right through the vitals of a wild animal that has no idea you're alive. It doesn't even know you're there until that arrow gets launched. And that to me is one of the most exciting things about archery. One of the most exciting things about it is how much it really does get you out of your comfort zone. How much it's so different than anything else you do. Because like a fight is more dangerous for you. There's more physical consequences. It's more nerve-wracking. It's scarier. But you got some time. Like, they shut that gate and, you know, they say, are you ready? Are you ready? Let's get it on. Come on. And, you know, sometimes you get knocked out quick, you know, and some that definitely happens. But most of the time, especially if you're good and you fight intelligently, you're moving around and you're avoiding trouble. You're trying to solve the problem. And, you know, it's up to your conditioning and your training to experience this thing and to try to get through it. So if it all goes well, you've gone through a 3-round or a 5-round fight. So longest case scenario for a championship round or a main event, 25 minutes. So in 25 minutes, you have enough time to figure out how to get it done and solve the riddle and the puzzle that your opponent presents. In bow hunting, you have one execution.
Yep.
So months and months and months and months. Say, for a tag in Iowa, super hard to get. For most people, you put in, you might get one every 5 years. And when a tag, for people who don't know anything about hunting, the way they keep the populations healthy is they regulate the amount of people that can hunt. So they have a limited amount of people that are allowed to hunt in the great state of Iowa. You get a tag every 5 years, and when you get that tag, you have as many days as you have off of work that you can make it out here to get it done.
Yep.
And there's a tremendous amount of pressure, and you have one deer tag. It all boils down to one shot on one wild animal. So a lot of tension there, a lot of shit going on.
That's like that's like saying you're going to be in a fight, but we're only going to give you one punch.
Yeah.
Each of you gets one, and we'll see who wins.
Sort of, but you're not going to get hit.
Right.
And you're punching them with an Easton Full Metal Jacket, you know, arrow going, I don't know how many feet, probably 290 feet a second.
No.
Probably somewhere around there.
Yeah, right?
Yeah,
you'd be equivalent to a 100-mile-an-hour fastball, I think.
Yeah, 100-mile-an-hour fastball with razor blades at the end of it. that's really what it is. But as
I'd probably watch the World Series if that's what they were chucking.
But as a discipline, there is more to it than just the pursuit of an animal. There's a bunch of shit going on, and I know people get tired of me talking about hunting sometimes, and they, you know, some people who are like animal lovers or vegetarians or something get really angry, and they don't even like these podcasts. But I'm just trying to relay what's going on in my mind, in my thought process, that this is like a meditation, like a discipline, and this incredibly difficult task, through it, You're trying to like find the layers of the onion. You're trying to dig deep into the heart of the thing to find out what it really is. It reveals itself to you. Even archery reveals itself to you through the intense pressure of bow hunting. Because there's like archery when there's a target and you're 20 yards away from it and you draw back and try to hit the X. You know, there's a little bit of pressure. And then you move the sight back to 40 yards. Then there's a little bit more pressure. And then you move it back to 80 yards. Whew, that's a long way.
Yeah.
Okay, I got to concentrate. Then, after all these arrows, then there's an animal. And then there's an animal, and it's moving. And it's walking. And what you have to do is wait to the moment where that thing stops. And there's tremendous pressure. And there's tremendous responsibility. And there's tremendous consequences. The last thing you want to do is see that arrow fly and hit that deer in the dick and have that thing run off screaming. And you're like, no. And you realize not only did you not kill it, you maimed it. It's probably going to live. Yeah. It's going to be in pain for months.
Yeah, you don't want that on your conscience.
No, you don't want that. So you have this massive requirement and massive responsibility of you. And through the intense pressure of this discipline, archery reveals itself. It reveals itself. It is a martial art, you know, and I know people don't look at it as a martial art because you're not throwing kicks and you're not choking people, but archery was developed initially for war, and that's one of the fascinating things about it, is developed as a weapon both to hunt and to kill other people, and that's really what it was intended for.
Yeah, it's definitely one of the most advanced penetrating, because armor came about, right?
Yeah.
And an arrow as a projectile is extremely efficient at penetration.
Yes.
because it's heavy mass with a very defined point
that of impact.
Of impact. And I told you about some a time where I did some work with Oakley on a ballistic helmet that they were doing for one of our military teams. And they brought me over because at the time I was at the U.S. Archery Training Center in Chula Vista. So I went over to Oakley and they had me shooting these masks that they had developed because they were saying they wanted to know whether or not an arrow could penetrate them. And they were confident that these things were going to work because they said it stops shotguns, it stops 9mm. They were like dropping these big steel staffs on them and everything was working. But when I looked at it, I said, I'm going to punch right through that thing. And they put them on crash dummy heads. And I shot them out in the Oakley parking lot at 100 yards. And dude, every one of those things were dead meat. There was arrow hanging out both ends. I probably have pictures on my computer.
What pound weight were you pulling?
It was my target bow. I was only pulling 60.
Wow.
And I told them, I said, there's so much energy being generated to the front of this tip. I said, even though this is made to block stuff that flattens, because like a bullet will flatten, so it disperses its energy out. And, you know, obviously you absorb a lot of that shock. If you get hit with a bullet and it flattens, that energy gets, you know, it gets connected into you.
You bruise.
Yeah, and you, it's shell, it's ribs. Shock.
Yeah.
Whereas with an arrow, it would just cut through, you know, unless it hit solid mass, it would cut through and go out, and you wouldn't even know it. It's just like when you cut yourself with a knife, and you're like, oh, crap. You know, and you kind of grab it. You know it's bad, but you don't really want to look. Whereas if you shot yourself in the finger with a gun, I mean, you know your whole hand would have felt it, right?
Right.
It's not like it's going to just feel like a paper cut. And that's really the difference.
Well, especially when you consider the fact that you're shooting a light arrow through a target bow. Like if you were using your hunting setup and a heavy arrow with... Oh, that's hilarious. He shot right through that thing.
I went through its eye out the back of the head.
That's so funny that they
pulled
thought,
it out. And then I signed a couple. I did some glasses too, but I signed "You're Dead."
That's hilarious. Yeah, that's funny that they thought it would be fine. Well,
see the penetration?
Yeah, that's not good.
They wouldn't let me show the helmets because they were using them.
Wow,
first.
That went a foot plus deep.
Kind of looks like Quigleyta.
It looks like Quigleyta and Uriah Faber had a baby.
It did. It does. I wish I remembered his name.
Look at Dudley looking all young and dapper.
I was.
So
no gray and hair.
That bow is, you know, not as powerful as your main bow, your hunting bow.
Uh-uh. Which
is, and the arrows aren't as heavy, and the heavier arrows get more. And you're using a field tip, too, right?
Yeah, yeah.
So you don't even have, like, a cutting tip on the front of the arrow.
I mean, you think back in medieval times, man, they were cutting through chainmail with arrows. That's what they were designed for.
Have you ever seen those? I wanted to ask you this before, and I always forget. Have you ever used one of those Mongol thumb rings? The Mongols had a very peculiar way of releasing their archery, their arrows. The way they would use the release on the bow, they had a ring, like a fat piece of bone, that would fit around their thumb, and they would hook with the thumb on the string, and this was how they would hold it. They would hold it like this, like almost like they're shooting pool.
Yeah.
So they reach over.
I've seen them do it, but I didn't know they had a ring.
So most people, they think of like Robin Hood style of pulling back a recurve where you would grab it with your fingers and pull it back with your fingers. But what they would do is that thumb ring comes out and they wrap that around. And if you go back to that picture that you had earlier, you could see that picture right there. See, that is where the cord, the drawstring,
yep,
hits on that, and the thumb goes through that loop, and then they wrap their finger around it. So that is what holds on. That seems to me to be a way better way than holding it with your fingers like this and just letting go with your fingers. It seems like it would be more repeatable. And also that hard surface.
Yeah. Would the probably... less fingers you have, mm-hmm. the more repeatable it'll be. That's
this guy's
right
got a
there.
Spoon. He's using. It looks like he's using a spoon.
He went metal. Some people don't like to mess around with
He's metal.
Could be titanium.
Yeah.
Could have melted down his first love's necklace and just went crazy.
Could have taken a cock ring and just stretched out part of it.
I think that is, for sure.
That's a cock ring.
It is.
But they used to, the Mongols used to use bone. There's like a whole series of them right there. It's pretty badass. I haven't seen any other people that have done this before. And this is something that I got into after I listened to the Hardcore History series on the Mongols. I really got super fascinated about them and their archery methods. They, according to Dan Carlin, at least, and he's done pretty extensive research, their bows were 160-pound pole recurves.
Yeah, they were tremendous. But they would have to be because they weren't near as efficient then. So
right.
They would have to be in order to generate the
I energy. Believe they invented the recurve, actually. I'm pretty sure.
The Mongols did?
Yeah, I'm pretty sure they were at least the first adopters. They might have invented it. Well, let's Google that shit. Who invented the recurve bow? What do you think? Take a guess. You're an archery fanatic. Who invented the recurve bow?
I would have to say it's either going to be them or...
I think it's the Mongols. I might have made that up, though. Let's see.
And the survey Boom. Says...
Who invented the recurve bow? Recurve bow.
I was going to say the Greeks. See?
Is that what it says? The Greeks? Second millennia BC. Wow. The recurve bow spread to Egypt, much of Asia in the second millennium BC. Okay, so I'm definitely wrong. Because the Mongols were, when you know, during the Genghis Khan days at least, that was 1200. So go to that Mongol bow in Wikipedia. It's a type of recurve this composite one? Bow. Look at that. They had a specific type of bow. A recurved composite bow. It can be two types of bow. From the 17th century onward, most of the traditional bows in Mongolia were replaced with a similar Manchu bow, which is primarily distinguished by larger, what's that word? Siyas? S-I-Y-A-H?
In the presence of prominent string bridges.
Hmm. The old Mongolian bows were used during the rule of Genghis Khan, were smaller than the modern Manchu-derived weapons used by most Nadam, N-A-A-D-A-M, paintings as well as at least one surviving example of a 13th century Mongol bow. Dude, I want that. Imagine having a 13th century Mongol bow. That would be the shoot.
I know. I've shot one before.
Have you really?
Yeah, I wanted to always shoot one off horseback, but I wasn't able to do it. I did. I'll try to find a... Trying to find a picture here for you, but I was presented one as a gift. I don't Whoa. Know where I've got it, but I've got one here. I've got a Mongol bow that
no
I was
kidding.
Given as a gift, and they said, well, traditionally these were always shot off horseback. That's why they're short.
Oh, that makes sense.
That's why they're short, so that you can do it. So I ended up. I was on one of my coaching tours through Europe. So the guy that was actually escorting me, his name was Andre. I actually got on his back, and I mean, I made him act like
a horse.
Like a horse.
That's ridiculous. You're a big guy.
Yeah, and he's about 65.
No.
Yeah.
You were riding a 65-pound man.
Riding him like Seabiscuit, dude.
You have a picture of that?
I'm going to find it.
I need to see a picture of you riding an old man. You might have killed him. That's not fair. What do you weigh? You got to weigh at least 240 pounds.
I'm up there. Yeah, I'm up there.
How tall are you?
230 right now.
Tall?
Yeah. Oh, tall? 6'5".
Yeah, you're a big motherfucker to be riding a 65-year-old man. I don't think any 65-year-old man should be carrying around 6'5 dudes. That's just me, though.
I know. Well, he was taking one for the team.
That's one that might break his back.
I know.
I don't want to take that one.
I've got the picture somewhere, but I'll have to post it later.
The Mongols, according to Dan Carlin, they had developed timing where they would release the bow as the horse was in the air so that it didn't disturb them with the bouncing. So
that totally makes sense.
So as the horse was in the air, that's when they would release.
That would, yeah. I think I would have figured that part out too.
Yeah, I mean,
your archery's come a long way, man.
Because of you, my friend. Because of you.
Well, I wasn't saying it for that reason, but
That is why.
Thoroughly impressed. You're a perfect protege because you applied everything taught. What I think so cool about archery is that people of any age can do it.
Mm-hmm.
Any age, any type of stature. We're going through. I got to show you some of these pictures. I wish.
Is it you riding a man?
Well, there will be a picture of me.
Is this like just coaching pictures?
Yeah, yeah, just thousands. But now that I'm going through them, I'm like remembering some of these people that I had to work with.
Well, people wouldn't even know why to laugh at that.
I know.
But one of the things about archery, you know, obviously, bow hunting, I think, is like one of the most extreme expressions of it. But I had no idea before I started practicing it how deep the rabbit hole goes. And I think that's the case with a lot of things. I think that's probably the case with most disciplines, most things that people do that are really difficult. I think that's certainly probably the case with golf and some other things that I've never tried. But with archery, I can't believe how much effort is involved in it. And I posted something about it on Instagram once about how rewarding it is and how difficult it is and how humbling it is, and you keep practicing and this is you on this man. That's hilarious. This is
horrible. How's my form?
It looks excellent, considering that you're crippling someone. We have to post that on Instagram. Save that and post that tonight so we'll have a link to
all
this.
All right.
That's another thing I want to ask you about. I'm sure you've seen this guy. His name is Lars Anderson.
Yeah, I've seen him.
Yeah, and he's got this method where he holds arrows in between his fingers of the hand he's drawing the bow back with. John's shaking his head right now.
I've got to call bull crap on that.
Really?
Yeah.
Well, how are you calling bull crap?
I think part of it was somewhat believable, and mm-hmm. why they held the arrows the way they did so they could load and shoot faster.
Yeah.
But, and I mean, there's no doubt if you would want him on your team because he has obviously perfected that technique.
Yeah.
But it's not like historically there's facts and stories around of people that had that type of skill.
You know, there are ancient photos or ancient drawings, rather,
of them
carrying the arrows that way.
I would definitely say they carry it that way because you could load it.
Mm-hmm.
But his method of like shooting and his trick style of shooting, I don't know if people would become that proficient with it.
I do. I think they would be. I mean, if that's what you did. I mean, think about the Mongols and the fact that they used that weapon so efficiently to dominate massive chunks of the world. And this is a conversation we were having earlier today.
Yeah, that was fascinating.
About the New York Times article that said that during Genghis Khan's day, they killed so many people, it changed the carbon footprint of the world. They killed 10% of the human population on Earth. 10% were directly connected to the Mongols. The Mongols had killed 10% of the Earth. That just, when you hear that, it just makes you think, how could that be done? How's that done? The numbers, the conservative numbers, are somewhere around 20 million. The liberal estimates go as high as 70.
It is an unreal number.
It's unreal.
But they were arguably madmen.
Madmen, 100%.
I mean,
100%.
It was crazy times. That's what we'd go to if all of a sudden everyone's cell phone shut off and like the sun stopped.
Well, if one group came along that was that ruthless, they're willing to take it that far. I mean, life in 1200 was just particularly ruthless, right? I mean, it was a brutal time to be alive. There was no medicine. There was no surgery. There was very little, at least. very little sophistication. And these people, most of them lived in felt tents. I mean, that's what most of the Mongols lived in. I mean, that's part of the name Genghis Khan and the doctrine that he lived by was that he was the ruler of all who lived in felt tents. And he believed that people who lived in tents were superior to people that lived in homes. And those people that lived in homes, they sort of dehumanized them. They thought they were pieces of shit living in a house. Fuck these people. They can't even live in a tent like a civilized person. And, you know, they were really crazy. I always encourage people to do this, but please, if you're listening to this and this isn't at all intriguing, go to Dan Carlin's Hardcore History. Apparently, now if you go on iTunes, you have to pay for the Wrath of the Khans ones. Because the way Dan Carlin's works, and it's only $1 a show, by the way, folks, and it's worth way more than that. And you say, I'm not paying for a podcast. It's not really a podcast. This is a podcast. John and I, we hunted all day. We had some dinner. We had a couple of drinks. And we said, we got to do this podcast. So we sat down. We're just shooting the shit.
Yep.
What Dan Carlin does is exhaustive research. And he works on these things for months at a time. And they're essentially like hour and a half hardcore history is the name of it. But that is what it is. It's a hardcore historical audio book on whatever subject he covers. And all of them are equally amazing. And the Hardcore History series on Wrath of the Khans is a 5-part series. It's one of my most cherished audio recordings. It's fucking incredible.
This episode is brought to you by Armra Colostrum. Colostrum is a safe, bioactive whole food that has long been the closed-guarded secret of insiders and the elite. But not anymore. Armra Colostrum, which in my opinion is the best colostrum on the market, is a premium bovine colostrum concentrate that utilizes proprietary cold-chain biopotent pasteurization technology to ensure its over 400 nutrients retain the purest integrity and bioavailability for maximum benefits. In research, Armra Colostrum has been found to confer 32% faster and stronger antibacterial immune protection than other colostrum products on the market. Plus, in a third-party clinical study, participants using Armra Colostrum experienced whole body benefits. 78% of the people noticed an improvement in their IBS symptoms. 80% saw improved strength, endurance, and lean muscle mass, and 87% reported improvement in their fitness recovery. Transform your health at the cellular level. Go to tryarmra.com/Rogan and enter the code Rogan to receive 15% off your first order. This episode is brought to you by Hostage Tape. First of all, what a great name. This is a product that I use, and I started using long before it was an ad. Your sleep game is about to get a whole lot better, kids, because I want to introduce you to Hostage Tape. Put simply, it is tape for your mouth. But you're probably wondering why you should even need that. Well, if you're a mouth breather, if you snore a lot, or if you suffer from sleep apnea, this could make a big difference. This mouth tape can reduce or eliminate snoring and apnea, and at the same time, it'll help filter the air going to your lungs, increase your oxygen uptake, and improve circulation, which will make you feel more energized. It has tons of other benefits, too, like it helps with bad breath, dry mouth, and of course, better sleep. For you and your partner, don't let bad sleep hold you hostage. Shut your fucking mouth with Hostage Tape. Buy it today and get a special buy two, get one free offer. That's a 90-day supply. Just visit HostageTape.com/Rogan. That's HostageTape.com/Rogan.
I've listened to it, no bullshit, maybe 30 times. I just keep listening to it over and over again just to absorb all the details because it's so crazy the way these people lived.
It is fascinating.
It's worth a buck a show, folks. Pay for it. It's not like my show. My show is a dollar show. Go on BitTorrent. Steal that fucking thing. This pay for it. Pay for this because it's a work of art. But archery, until modern times, consisted of the sophisticated leaps in technology were just like the recurve bow and more efficient and better recurve bows and better materials. Until the compound bow came along, which was when?
I don't know. I'm trying to think when it was.
I'm going to guess.
70.
Fred Bear invented it, didn't he?
I think it was the Allen.
Oh, was it? Okay, who invented the combat bow? Who invented the compound bow?
First compound bow.
Let's find
out. I'm not a historian.
How dare you not be a historian?
I just shoot.
All right, let's see. What does it say here?
Oprah's Allen.
Crying. Why is Oprah crying?
Oprah's crying.
Oh, shocking. Oprah, secrets revealed. Oh, okay.
Wilbur Allen changed the face of archery forever when he decided that he'd make a bow by sawing off part of the limbs of a recurve and attaching pulleys.
Ah.
1960s.
Okay. Yeah. Why do I think it was Fred Bear? I think I watched some bear archery propaganda. That's why.
Dang it all.
Yeah. Okay. So, Hollis, H-O-L-L-E-S-S, Wilbur Allen.
Yep.
And that was in the 1960s. That's interesting because that looks like a modern-day elite bow. Inside joke, folks. Just kidding. If you're an elite shooter and you're like, what the fuck? You don't know shit about archery. You're right. I don't. I'm just joking.
Yeah, we're Googling stuff.
Don't get so uppity. Don't get so attached to your shit, goddammit. So 1960s is when it became what it is now, or the beginning of what it is now. But what we're shooting with
1966.
Is these new, right before I was born. What we're shooting with now is these new Hoyt Pro Defiance. This one that I got literally 3 days ago is the best bow I've ever shot. It's amazing. It's so good. It feels so good when you shoot with it. It's so smooth and it's so accurate. It's incredible how far the technology has come. I mean, we're shooting today out to 80 yards, and I shot the day before that 85 yards, and regularly placing it in the 10 ring at 80 yards.
Yep.
I mean, that's an incredible sophistication in technology.
And you're shooting 84 pounds.
Yeah, it's heavy.
With a 500 grain arrow, that is...
Shit's going to die.
Ballistic heads would implode if you were hitting them. Like, if you were at Oakley...
Oh, yeah, that's not
good. They'd
need
a new backstop.
That's a different thing. Yeah, well...
We had this discussion, though. It's all about what you can physically manage.
We had this discussion on your podcast. You listen to this podcast, you want to hear another drunken, rambling bullshit fest. John and I did an episode of Knock On, which is, if you're getting into archery, John's podcast is, in my opinion, the best archery podcast in the world. It's the most informative, and it's how John and I became friends. We became friends because I went to Hoyt. And Hoyt, the company that makes these bows, I went there with my family because I was in Salt Lake. And I don't like skiing, man. I don't like it. It's fucking boring to me. But I do it because my family likes it. They're like, we're going down the hill. I'm like, all right, I'll go. Fine. I'm like, oh, but please, can we just stop in at Salt Lake City so I can visit the Hoyt factory? I want to check it out. So, and I was in there and I was talking to Mike Looper. And Mike Looper, one of the big wigs over at Hoyt. And I was telling him, I listen to that John Dudley's podcast all the time. That podcast's amazing. I'm like, it's so informative. And then Looper told you, and then somehow or another he connected us, and next thing you know, you're giving me some coaching.
Here, it's funny because Mike's a practical joker. He's always, like, he'll always call, and then he starts out with, like, hi, is Mr. Dudley there? Like, he always does these different voices. And he's always playing jokes. Well, anyway, Sharon and I went to Hoyt like 2 hours after you were there.
Oh, that's funny. That's hilarious.
We pull in, and then Mike's like, dude, Rogan was just here, and he loves your podcast. And I'm like thinking, here we go. And he's like, no, seriously. And I'm like, oh, yeah, does he? And he's like, yeah. And he's like, he's in town. He's skiing, and he's going to go over to the Western Expo. And I said, well, that's what we're here for. We're going to be over at the Western Expo because we actually went for Felt Bikes because Felt put their bikes at the Western Expo. And they said, will you come here and, like, give a testimony that you use these things?
Well, explain what a Felt bike is because we've been using them all week. They're awesome. They're mountain bikes that have, like, assisted...
It's an e-bike.
Mm.
So it has a pedal assist, It has a Bosch motor on it. And as long as you're pedaling, you can. It has a battery that you charge. And as long as you're pedaling, you can. You have four settings, and you can use a setting where it actually assists you. And it, the way I describe it is each one of those numbers, whether it's Eco, Sport, Tour,
Turbo,
whichever one it is, it's almost like that is equal to one other person being on your bike.
I want to just tell you something. I never use those things with anything less than turbo. Whatever it was set at, I was like, turbo, shut the fuck up.
And they're unbelievable. As long as you're turning the pedals,
it's effortless.
They'll go 17 miles an hour, which I think is what, by law, anything that goes over that, I think it gets kind of classified as a different type of. It's not eligible to go on non-motorized trails.
Mm-hmm.
So you can use these bikes on non-motorized paths, like in Montana and stuff. You'd be able to take these, like where Green Tree went. You'd be able to take a bike on that same trail.
Well, what's important about it is two things. One, you can charge these things with solar power
because
yep. they're electrical. And two, one of the things that happens in these cold weather hunts is you hike far and wide up mountains. And if you didn't do a good job of layering, so like you might have like too much clothes on the way up there. And you start sweating.
Mm-hmm.
And then once you get there, then you're hunting. So you're not climbing hills anymore.
You're stopped.
Now you're stopped. You're freezing, and you fucking freeze. And hypothermia is the number one cause of death in the mountains.
Is it
the number
really?
One? Yes. It kills more people than grizzly bears, rattlesnakes, mountain lions. People fucking freeze to death. And when you're up there and you sweat, and you, especially if you're wearing cotton, one of the biggest improvements that people figured out was merino wool, because if you wear merino wool, there's something about the natural fibers in wool that allow you to stay warm. It retains
this is
heat.
Wool.
Is it?
Yeah.
This is an Under Armour shirt.
Mm-hmm.
Well, First Light has an awesome merino wool selection, and I know Kuyu has a lot of merino wool, and Under Armour, which what I'm wearing right now, they have a bunch of merino wool stuff too.
Yeah,
right?
They've got a ton of different styles.
Yeah, merino wool is like it's big with the hiking crowd and outdoorsmen and backpackers and stuff.
Wool has an amazing characteristics. There's a lot of cool stories about wool. People that were on like plane crashes or shipwrecks, and the only ones that survived at sea were the ones that had wool. Everyone else would die of hypothermia.
Mm.
When we, I was with a company that did some merino wool, started a line of merino wool. So we brought in a lot of specialists from New Zealand that actually showed us the different kinds of merino wool and stuff. And then that's when you started to learn a lot about the stories of merino wool. And there's a ton of survivor stories with people that would wear wool versus trying to wear other type of synthetics. And like, you know, obviously that was an extreme case. So it was pretty interesting.
That's fascinating. You know, another thing about it is it for whatever reason, it doesn't stink.
Yeah.
Like, I've been wearing wool socks. I always wear wool socks when I would do any type of hunting or hiking or anything where I know my feet are going to be sweaty. It makes such a big difference. You take off your socks, it doesn't even smell like you're warm. It doesn't make any sense. Whereas if I wear cotton socks, it smells like someone died in my shoes. It smells like there's a goddamn eco-tastrophe going on inside my Nikes. It's horrible. The smell. Like, if you work out all day and you keep your socks on, and they just sweat and then fester and the bacteria grows. There's some natural antimicrobial properties of merino wool. It's awesome stuff.
Very awesome.
So, felt bikes.
Get back to
Great
Mike
Western
Looper.
Expo.
Yeah, so Looper Mike tells Looper. Me that you like the podcast, and he could tell by my face. I figured this was another one of the Mike Looper pranks. So I was like, okay, and I said, well, I said if he wants to hook up, then you know, then connect us or whatever. So we're back at the hotel, and Sharon and I, we went and checked in. We're there maybe 2 hours. And Mike texts me. He says, Joe and Cam are in the Mountain Ops booth right now doing a podcast. Go by there and say hi to him. And I'm like, oh, really? And he said, yeah. And I'm like, okay. So I literally hung up with him, and I told Sharon, I'm like, yeah, I'm not going over there. I said, I'll guarantee you they're doing a podcast, and I'm going to go over there and be like, hey, Joe, Mike told me that he wanted to meet me. And then you'd be like, who the F are you? So I just like, Mike's like, did you connect with him? I said, no. And he's like, why not? And I said, I didn't believe you. So he was crying wolf too many times, see? And I didn't take him serious when he was telling the truth. But then you called me out on Twitter, which I wasn't really a Twitter guy. You kind of, I think you sent me something or you said something, and then.
I think I just said how much your podcast is awesome.
Yeah, and I got blasted by all my friends. Oh my God, Joe Rogan's like talking about your podcast. So,
yeah. Well, it's just very rare that someone specializes in something to the extreme that you do with archery, where you don't even like when I do a podcast, like in this podcast is a perfect example. Like many times during this podcast, I've had to say, well, for people who don't know, that means this. Or for people who haven't heard that, that's it. You don't even bother doing that. You start talking about AC-10s and different cams. And
should I?
ZX cam. No, you shouldn't. Because what you're doing is it's a hardcore archery podcast. And it is, you know, catch up if you can. Stay with it if you can. But you go deep, deep, deep into all of the variables of archery. And for me, it makes me understand and appreciate. I've been shooting bows for a few years now and really hardcore for most of the time, like really into it most of the time. Still, there's a lot of shit you talk about when I don't know what the fuck you're saying. Because it's so detailed. There's so much going on. But also because you were a very successful target archer. Which is, you know, of course you see in, you know, you see it on television in the Olympics and all this different stuff. Target archery, which is almost as specialized and weird in its own way as hunting, as bow hunting is.
Yep. Yeah. Target archery's, you learn so much about the sport, one. You really start to have to learn your equipment. And then for me, I really learned a whole new aspect of just competitiveness, preparation, diet, how to travel smart, because it's a huge investment to go to tournaments across the world. You know, you look at some of those over there, you know, from Poland or Sweden or...
What was the biggest tournament that you won?
I don't know. They're all different. I don't think any one of them... I always liked winning the team rounds the best. I always loved shooting team rounds. I got really pumped up with that. I don't really remember very many of them. I do remember, but I don't. See, what I was trying to get to, and this segues into it, I started shooting competitive archery to be a better bow hunter. That's the only reason I competed, because I was in the same mental state as what you were of, okay, if I'm going to go out and do this, I want to know that if I've got one shot, I want to make sure that it's right. Because when I started, I was never taught properly. I was just, we hunted a lot for our family's food. I was down in Mississippi when I was younger, is where I lived. And I made a lot of mistakes. I would miss a lot and just, you know, I was self-taught. I think I was with a lot of people that just like, you know, they'd pick it up and just try to do it. And you spend a lot of time sitting and waiting for an opportunity, and then when you blow it, it's extremely frustrating. So I just decided to start shooting competitive archery, and I ended up shooting one little tournament, and then all of a sudden I realized, wait a minute, this is what's like going to make me a really good bow hunter. Because when I shot my first tournament, it made me realize how bad of a hunter I was from a point of being able to make a shot. So I'm like, I have to get better at this, because if I'm going to be hunting and I'm going to be spending that much time for an opportunity, I have to be able to seize the moment. Mm. So, and the reason I left the U.S. team was because that year, when they posted the schedule, the World Cup final was at the end of September. And so I knew that September would be training and then we'd have to fly mid-September. So if I wasn't willing to commit to go to the World Cup final, then I wasn't. I couldn't stay on the team. So that was elk season. I mean, and that's actually what I said. I just told him, I said, listen, I do not shoot tournaments between September and December. That's it. And I won't be doing that tournament if that's what it is. And then they just said, well, you're not going to be able to stay on the team. And I just said, okay. And that was it.
They don't get it. They never heard it. And you see that 1,000-pound forest horse with swords coming out of its head running over the top of the hill. Until you've seen a bugling elk in the rut just foaming at the mouth and jizzing all over himself, literally jizzing all over himself.
Yeah.
I mean, and this massive, majestic beast that looks like it's like in the Lord of the Rings or something. I mean, it really is. There was someone put something up on Twitter, and I thought it was really interesting because it was from the perspective of someone who's a complete non-hunter. And it was just a bugling elk screaming. And they were like, the most insane sounds that elk make when they bugle. And the comments were like, whoa, this thing is like some mythical beast. Because somebody caught a really cool, like, you know, elk, like people, they have different voices.
Yep.
And some elk have just badass voices.
Yeah.
Especially those herd bulls. Like, the way elk works, folks, if you don't know, there will be, like, when I was elk hunting recently, last month, Cam and I found this one bull that at the ranch they were calling the sword bull because he had just these crazy long beams growing out of the side of his head. It was like a really odd, sometimes you get odd-shaped beams that grow out of these animals' heads. And he was the stud of the ranch. And there was, like, he had at least 12 chicks with him, 12 female cows.
And that's a pretty small
following
harem.
Him everywhere.
That's a pretty small harem.
Well, for, you know, a herd bull, I guess. But it was watching all those little satellite bulls hang around this guy. There's like a few, like, hey, girls, I'm pretty cool, too. He's like, shut up! And
yeah.
Then, and then he would run them off.
Was he a groaner?
He was a screamer. You know that sound that they make, but
yeah, I know it. Some of them, once they get blown out, they just get to the point where they're like, it's like a bullfrog, like a real old one. They can't really bugle anymore, so they're just like, and it sounds terrible. But you know, they're called, you know, everyone calls them like groaners. Mm-hmm. And if you're an elk hunter, when you hear a real blown out bugle like that, you know it's probably a super old bull. Have you ever seen an Irish elk?
No, what is that?
You haven't?
No, what is
They're extinct now. Check this out, dude. You have to Google this. An Irish elk. Right here.
These used to roam
the earth right here.
Whoa. Oh my god.
They were awesome. Look at that thing. Is it awesome or what?
It looks like a combination of a stag and an elk.
But they're way more massive. They're still finding some. Look at that thing.
Whoa! It's like a moose thing.
It's an Irish elk. You need to look them up. They're amazing.
When did they die off?
I think it said 20th century.
No kidding. Wow.
Let's see. Wait. No, let's look at it right here. Most remains of Irish elk date between 11,750 before present.
So definitely not the 20th century. I wonder why they died off. That's interesting.
I don't know.
There was an enormous eagle that used to live in New Zealand. God, I'm trying to remember the name of it. Google enormous eagle in New Zealand. God, I'm trying to remember.
Enormous eagle.
New Zealand. Because they'll give you harpy eagle, which is the biggest eagle that exists today. You know, you can just go like that and then like that.
Oh.
You hit that down button. Host eagle, that's it. That was the biggest eagle ever. And they were so big, they would eat people.
What?
510 pounds.
Are you kidding
yeah,
me?
Yeah, they had a 10-foot wingspan.
Look at that freaking thing.
Dude, 510-pound eagle with a 10-foot wingspan. Hello!
That's straight out of Harry Potter, dude.
Yeah, amazing. And they were so big and so powerful. And New Zealand, if you don't know, does not have a lot of indigenous mammals. New Zealand was really shut Dang, off from the rest of the world. Yeah, it's thing. Called HAAST Eagle. It was new, and I believe they went extinct in the 1400s. Is that what it says? What does it say? Yeah, 1400. And the reason why they went extinct, they were hunted to extinction by the first Maori, but that is a little bit controversial. Some people think that it wasn't necessarily that, but that the Maori ate everything that they ate, and they didn't have any food left. But there were a lot of accounts by the Maori of them eating people. Oh my God! Look at the size of this Irish elk.
See, you're not appreciating it. I've seen an actual one that's in a museum.
So that says 2.10 meters tall
to the bottom of
to
the
bottom of the bottom, like before the face.
Yeah.
Why do they measure there? Why don't they measure the top of his head? So that's way bigger than a regular elk.
Way bigger.
Oh my God!
Way bigger.
That looks like it's several thousand pounds. Look at that picture of these people next to it.
Exactly.
Oh my God. Oh my God. Folks, what it looks like is a bull with long legs and like a moose on steroids antlers. Wow. Irish elk.
Aren't they cool?
See,
they're fascinating
fuck
to me.
Bringing back woolly mammoths. They need to bring back that thing and do it on New Zealand so you can hunt it. Make it, you know, that's another, like, in New Zealand, it's kind of weird because they don't have hunting tags or seasons for most of their animals. You just go there and fucking go crazy and shoot everything because they have no predators. So they have all these ungulates. Yeah, they have all these ungulates, all these animals that exist there. And unfortunately, that's like an amazing animal. Unfortunately, a lot of the animals in New Zealand are also in these high fence operations. So, like, you'll go over there and, you know, there'll be, you know, a few hundred acres or a few thousand
Check
acres,
that
depending
out.
On where
an
you're
arrow
at.
In there. It's like an What's old that? Drawing
Someone shot
of
an
Irish
arrow in
elk.
It?
These, like, people chasing it down.
With their shitty arrows. They barely penetrate. Look, they backstrapped them.
Backstrap.
Yeah, look where they hit them.
I know. Well,
terrible picturing. Even the drawing sucks. They didn't even know how to do archery even with a drawing.
At least put it in the right spot.
You missed. Dude, you
for
missed.
For all the haters out there about this hunting podcast,
yeah.
We
historically
have we thoroughly enjoyed our what we've been eating?
Oh, yeah, man. God. So good. Man,
we made a few posts on the...
Yeah.
We've had elk tenderloins. Mm. I've talked to you about hog hunting. I'm a big advocate of... I love shooting hogs. I love shooting gators. We had a ridiculously good pork shoulder today.
Incredible. That was your friend Preston made it.
Preston made it.
Incredible.
Dynamite.
How many hours did he cook it for? Slow cooked it for
17?
Something crazy. I mean, it was falling apart as you stick a fork into it. But yeah, we've been eating wild game. Amazing wild game. I think wild pig hunting is one thing that almost everybody wants to do. Like even Bill Burr, my friend Bill, who's never expressed any interest in hunting. I give him elk whenever he comes and does my podcast. Like he came last week and I gave him a bunch of elk. And he loves meat. He eats meat. He goes, yeah, I'd go wild pig hunting. I go, really? He goes, yeah, you want to take me wild pig hunting? I go, fuck yeah, dude, let's do it. So I'm going to take him pig hunting. Pig hunting is the one. Like even my agent is she's the nicest lady. Shout out to Stacy. She's a sweetheart. And she loves animals. She loves dogs. She rescues dogs. She loves cats. She loves all animals. And when she finds out that I hunt, she's like, oh, I don't know how I feel about that. I go, but you eat meat. She goes, I know. She goes, you should hunt pigs. I go, why? She goes, because they're ugly. I'm like, what?
That's what Sharon started out with. Sharon, my wife is from England, and she started out having no interest in hunting herself. But then when she started to realize just how many deer there were, she was like, this is a necessity.
because, here in Iowa, for sure.
Well, and we were in Wisconsin at the time. And then she really wanted to do it, but like you, she said, I don't want to go unless I know I'm totally proficient. So she shot for a long time first, learned the proper way, shot. And then she said, you know, from the hunting aspect, I think if I'm going to, like, actually hunt, I think I want to start with something, like, maybe ugly, like a Russian hog or something, like a Russian boar. Because, like, those boars are... They overrun certain parts of Florida, like on those sod farmers. We do a lot of hunting on sod farms, and we're down there with Osceola Outfitters. Hoppy Kempfer is his name, and it's amazing how good the pig hunting is, but it's also equally amazing at how much destruction they do to his place. I mean, he runs hunts 360 days a year. And there's people shooting them every single day, and there's still just tons.
It's crazy. Well, when you talk about how they breed, that's where it gets so shocking when you find out that they can get to full maturity in 6 months. They have a litter, and I believe they're only pregnant for 6 weeks. And then they shit out the kids. Get out of there. And then 6 months later, they're having kids of their own. And they can do that cycle, I think, 3 times a year.
Yep.
And they can have a ton. I mean, they can have a ton of babies. And they just keep multiplying over and over and over and over again. And unless someone comes along and shoots them, there's not enough mountain lions in the world to keep a cap on that. They're not going to be able to do it. Pigs are very smart, too. They're super smart. They're super tuned in. Their eyesight sucks, but their sense of smell is incredible.
Yeah, ridiculous.
Yeah, they smell you a fucking mile away and like, see ya, dude. And they just start running, head over the hill.
They do so much damage to fences, too.
Mm-hmm.
I think someone told me something like, if they can get their snout into something, then they can get their whole body through it. Like, they have that much will. So if they can get the snout, like, into the fence or under the fence, they will be through it.
Jesus.
Yeah, they do some crazy damage.
They find a way.
They find a way, for sure.
Well, they're so fucked up that it's the only animal in North America that allow you to hunt from a helicopter with a machine gun. Where in Texas, they're like, go ahead. But that is so Texas. You know, we have a hog problem. What should we do? Man, you know what I've been thinking? I've been thinking about helicopters, man. Helicopters and machine guns. Like, what the fuck who let this guy in the meeting? Man, we got to curb these things. I'm thinking nuclear weapons. No. Okay, how about helicopters? All right, helicopters. Yep. Helicopters and machine guns over nuclear weapon. All agreed? Okay, next item on the agenda. So they have this thing called Hella Hunters, and there's an episode of Pigman. There's a show called Pigman, and Pigman just goes around shooting pigs all the time. He got the name Pigman, and he lives in Texas where, again, it has to be done. Texas has millions of pigs. They have so many pigs that Texas opened up a new road. I forget where the road was. They opened up a new road, and they had 40 car accidents the first night from people slamming into pigs. That's when you know you got a fucked up problem. So
go ahead.
Because this episode of Pigman is called Apocalypse Now. And Apocalypse Now is with Ted Nugent and Pigman. You can watch it on YouTube. They get in a fucking helicopter, and they shoot 250 pigs in a day. And they're flying around, and they're just duck, 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 like a goddamn platoon movie. Duck, 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 duck. And they're hitting these pigs in the head as the pigs are running full clip, and the pigs are flipping head over feet. I mean, it's fucked up. And you know they're not eating those things. Half of them are just going to leave there. No one cares. They just have to do something. Try to curb that population. Now, if you did that with lambs, or with deer, you know, or any normal farm animal, we have a hierarchy of animals that will allow people to do that too.
Yeah, it is funny that people have that. They've got that one thing. Whereas, as soon as you start shooting a deer, they're not cool with it.
Or the big one is bears, right?
Yeah, bears are certainly the biggest.
That's the big one.
Yeah.
But again, I mean, bears, it's the same thing. If you go where the rivets live up in Alberta, man, black bears are everywhere. They have so many bears.
Anywhere in Canada, there's a lot of them. Tons of bears.
And the only thing stopping their population growth is hunters.
Yep.
That's it. But so back to this Apocalypse Now thing. The like I said, the episodes are on Twitter, but if you need to just – it gives you also a good sort – I don't think you'll ever get it unless you see giant packs of pigs. What do they call it? A litter? What do they call – no. What do they call a pack of pigs?
I think pack of pigs sounds pretty good.
Pack? You know what they call pig Aborigines? Pack. You know, Adam Greentree, our buddy from Australia, he owns a mining company.
He owns a fencing company.
He does mining, right? He's involved in a lot of mining operations.
I don't know that part.
Okay, but anyway, he employs a bunch of Aborigines. And so he got to know them really well. And, you know, he told me some fascinating stories about their culture and their histories. Really interesting stuff. But one of the things that's crazy is when you call a group, you don't call them a tribe. They call themselves a mob.
Is that just their terminology for it?
Yeah, the terminology is a mob, like an Aborigine mob.
Obviously, it's just a different meaning than the mob.
Yeah, either. Not like the mob, like in the mafia. Like, that's just a pack, you know, a tribe, a group, a clan. You know, they call themselves a mob. And he said, they'll have one language and that they speak. And then 10 miles over, there's another group that has a totally different language and they can't speak each other's language.
Kind of like England.
Is England like that?
Like the dialects?
Oh, but they're still speaking
yeah,
English.
Yeah.
These people are not speaking.
I think in Africa it's like that too. There's a lot of, you go from tribe to tribe and it's almost like a completely different, different dialect. Totally. Well,
that's probably where the whole Tower of Babel story came from the Bible. You know, back when there was not that much travel, when you had to ride a fucking horse to get somewhere.
If you're lucky. And had one.
So it's probably, once you crossed over a mountain range or something like that, those fuckers over there, they were
speaking
totally
different.
Invented
a whole new language.
Yeah, like look at Europe. You know, you could just travel a short distance and you're dealing with completely different languages, totally different culture.
Well, yeah, I was in Sweden doing some coaching with their national team, and you know, you can be in Italy or you can be in France or you can be in Germany in no time. And I mean, it's completely different culture, completely different language, completely different people, different food,
different history. It's amazing, and it's all smaller than a segment of the United States,
and that's with vehicles.
Yeah,
so I mean, imagine.
Before horseback.
Yeah, you've been in some of the mountains we've elk hunted in. Would you really want to have to go two or three mountain ranges over because if you had a cool little house and some running water and a little place to dump and all that stuff, you'd be kind of happy right there.
Yeah.
Hey, I think I'm just going to go walk over here and risk hypothermia because I don't have merino wool on.
How long did you travel for archery?
I did just, I think I've done three passports.
Three full passports?
Well, with extensions. 1.3 million miles I've got flying.
Wow. All shooting bows and arrows.
Shooting a bow. You know what's crazy is 3 years ago, Sharon and I went to, and Harry, our son, went to Mexico for a vacation.
Mm-hmm.
And it was the first time I'd ever traveled without a bow case.
Whoa. That was Puerto Vallarta?
Yep.
That's crazy. Yep. We were down there at the same time.
Yep. That was our return. Yeah, no kidding. That was weird. I was literally getting on the plane to go home, and you were just getting there the same exact time.
Fucking love Puerto Vallarta. Oh. So awesome.
I'm going back, Jack.
Yeah, it's a good spot. It's a good spot.
Right when this rut's done, here's what's going to happen. I'm going to be sitting in a tree for 13 hours a day for about another 21 days. And when that's done, I'm going to sleep for about 3 days. I'm going to shave this face. And I'm going to sling some Onnit kettlebells around like 3 or 4 hours a day.
You got a beach body?
Yep, and I'm gonna get my I'm gonna get my PV body going. But no, since I met you, you got me hooked on Onnit, and it's totally changed me. Because when I did in September, well, I start hunting in October 24 or August 24th is when I start. I start in Alberta, and then I work my way through several states and a lot of different tags. But I went 30 days with all I ate was one meal a day. I'd eat a meal at night. But I lived off the TPC packs. I would pack them all in a big 1 gallon Ziploc bag. I'd do the TPC packs for morning and evening. I would do 3 Alpha Brains that I'd put in 3 different bottles of water throughout the day. One of the Total Gut Health. And then I would do 2 of the Omega bars and 2 of the Tonka bars. And I lived off that for 30 days.
That's all you ate?
Yeah, and I was
you ate that for dinner too? That was your dinner?
I would normally cook some kind of a dinner at night.
So, but that was what you were eating during the day?
Yep.
Why did you limit yourself to so little food?
Because I was always in my backpack.
Oh, I see.
And it was like super portable. It was easy to travel with.
So you were doing the hardcore backpack hunting?
It wasn't truly hardcore. It was just... I think if you're hunting... I like to try to get as much rest as I can, because if you shoot something, you're up all night, and then a lot of these places I have multiple tags, so I'm right back at it the next day. Like in Alberta, I think I was there 9 days, and I think I did 87 miles on my little Garmin is what I covered on feet. So you burn a lot of calories, and then obviously, Montana is way more rugged than Alberta. I mean, it was some of that stuff. I bet I did half the distance, but I feel like I was probably having to put twice the effort in. But it totally sustained me when that would, that's pretty hard beating on you. Just living out of a backpack, really, and limited sleep and being in different places. I wish I would have had that when I competed.
Well, keeping those neurotransmitters at good levels is so important. It's one of the reasons why if I fly somewhere and I land, I do two things like right away. One, unless I get there at night and I'm tired, I just go to sleep. But one of the first things I do is I do a 30-minute workout. You don't even have to kill yourself. Minimum of 30 minutes.
Yep.
I like to go to the gym and just get everything going. Just fire up those engines, blow out those pipes, get that blood flowing. And if I don't do that, I don't feel as good. It takes me a day or two to adjust. But if I do that, and then I have a nice salad or a healthy meal afterwards, I feel great. The other thing is Alpha Brain. It's so important to me to get those levels of your neurotransmitters high, because it's one of the things that affects you the most about jet lag and travel.
Yep.
The sleep pattern's off and your brain chemistry's all funky. I take New Mood and I take Alpha Brain. New Mood's great, but Alpha Brain is imperative. I have to take it. If I do a UFC, I have to take it. Anytime where my mind has to be fired up for long periods of time.
Yeah, I do notice a difference with it. And I like the peach one that you put in with water.
Mm-hmm.
Because I don't enjoy drinking water, but I drink a lot throughout the day. So having a few of those that I can do throughout the day with some flavoring.
Yeah, it tastes good. It doesn't have any sugar.
Yeah. See, I like a little taste, but I don't like sugar. Sugar would put me off if I tasted it. But yeah, they've been awesome. And the New Moods... I normally take 4 of those at night with that TPC night pack, and
does that fuck with your dreams?
I love it. I get into some crazy dream modes.
Yeah, Alpha Brain does that too. Alpha Brain gives me these bizarre lucid dreams.
That's what you told me. So I'm like I do a TPC night. I do. I had a TPC night now. I'll take 4 New Moods. But then I'll have one of my Alpha Brains if I'm at home is when I go to bed.
Whoa.
I like to dream, because then I at least feel like I'm getting true deep sleep.
it sounds like you're having adventures. Like, if you're taking that much, you must be having, you must be on magical mystery tours every night. Ta-da! A magical mystery tour. Yeah, it's, I'm glad. I'm glad you got into that. I'm glad you also, I know you did a lot of work with some of those guys down at the Onnit Academy, and you learned a lot of shoulder mobility exercises and shoulder strengthening exercises. Mm-hmm. That I think could be really critical for archers. You know, archery is as much as it is about technique and as much as it is about proper form and, you know, proper execution, there's also muscle involved. There's also strength involved. And obviously, it's an athletic endeavor. You're dealing with your body. And I think it's really cool that you're developing like a program of specific things that you feel would benefit archers, give them shoulder stability, range of motion. I know we did some of them yesterday with the club bells, yep. Which I find really beneficial for a lot of things. Club bells, and one of the things I like about them is that they're really awkward. It's exactly what it sounds like. It's a club. It's an iron club. So there's this long handle, and then there's a lot of mass at the top of the handle. And it's not like a lot of
stubby
weight.
Baseball bat made yeah. out of cast iron is dang near what it would mm-hmm. be a good description.
Yeah, and I have some longer, heavier ones at home that I've really gotten into. And when I say heavier, I'm only talking about 35 pounds.
Yeah.
That's all you need. I mean, you don't need that much. We're doing these exercises called shield casts. It's so difficult to do, to take a 35-pound club with all the weight at the end of it, so it's weird leverage, yep. and then control it, swinging it over the top of your head and then bringing it down with full control of it and pausing it in front of you. I think that's incredible for archery, and I think it would be incredibly beneficial for stability of your front arm and having the strength to be able to hold your front arm there without any strain or any like shaking or weirdness.
Yeah, just your scapula stability is a huge weakness point in archery. When archers break down, it's normally because of super weak scapular stability muscles. And there's a lot of different movements that they taught me at the Onnit Academy. Because I really wanted to go there to, one, I think since you showed me some of the first moves you showed me with just kettlebells, I realized this is stuff I'd use every day. I mean, you've been here 4 days. How often am I picking up that felt bike, putting in the back of my truck?
Quite a bit.
Slinging, you know, picking up. Slinging feed sacks or whatever. I mean, that's like true useful strength and mobility and flexibility. And so all these movements teaches that. And I really wanted something that one thing I learned to appreciate when I lived in England with Sharon for a long time was some people just don't have the space to have very much workout equipment.
Mm.
With kettlebells and some teams, like some of the teams I work with, especially with some of the smaller countries, they don't have huge budgets. But with kettlebells, they can. That's a minimal investment, and it's a minimal space usage too. You can take two kettlebells and keep them in a corner. It's not like you got the total gym with Chuck Norris, you know, yeah. hiding in the corner. It's wasting a bunch of space. And I really wanted to go and, one, learn proper technique and learn different movements and then realize, okay, which ones actually work good for archery or what ones can help archers. And my plan was originally we were going to do some videos with those guys at the Onnit Academy specific for some archers. But this hunting season I've been so busy. I mean, and even right now I'd like to be able to go, but I'm in no way having time just because I'm trying to get my hunts done, trying to finish the TV show and do all that stuff and time, but it is on the schedule because I think so many people are going to benefit from learning super simple movements that really increase your range. Like that steel mace, I like just because of how much range it teaches you all the way around. You mm-hmm. know, you're getting so much range in that shoulder joint, and you're really having to focus on that scapular stability all the way around. And then you, even when you come around to the front, you know, even though it doesn't look like you're doing much, if you're doing it properly, you're really engaging your core to seat everything down and to bring everything to center. And so much of being stable as an archer is having a solid platform and a solid base. And that core stability is what where all that radiates from. If the core is loose or unstable, then obviously everything outside of that is going to be the same way.
Yeah, and especially when you consider when you do archery, you're pulling with your back and your scapula is involved in the drawing of the bow and also in the making the bow release, the executing the shot. Another exercise that I think is critical for archers is chin-ups. And I think that if I could say one piece of equipment, if you could only afford one, get a chin-up bar. I think chin-up bars are giant, especially a good one that actually comes off the wall. Like if you can invest in one, you have the space, and you just, you know, get it mounted on some studs in your house. It's so critical. I think I was going to say. First of all, hangs are so good for your shoulders. And there's a bunch of articles and videos. You can watch some videos on YouTube by some doctors. I was first turned on to this by Steve Maxwell. He told me about this. There was a doctor, this particular doctor, I'm sorry, I forget his name, but I'm sure you can find it really quickly. And he invented this method of hanging and releasing tension and pressure in the shoulder joint because he thinks that a lot of the pain that people suffer from, impacted shoulders, is really just a function of our bodies are designed. We have essentially like ancient primate genetics and ancient primate structure. And one thing primates, almost all of them, have in common is they swing from things by their arms. They hang by their arms. They swing by their arms. And that pulling and stretching and lengthening of those that soft tissue and those tendons, that's imperative to both the stability of the shoulder and the alleviation of pain in the range of motion. I've experienced some really great results with hanging from my shoulders and also from something that I learned from you, which is hanging from a chin-up bar and then with my arms completely extended, just contracting the scapula. So just contracting, and I'll hold that for as long as I can, and then I'll release again.
Yeah, so you're almost hanging to the point where you let your shoulders fully extend to where you feel like you're on the verge of letting go of something if you're hanging. But then in that same position, you literally take your shoulder sockets and almost pull them down to your armpits. So
without bending your arms.
Yeah, you don't bend your arms. You're not using any bicep.
And there's a video of John doing it online too. You can find that. Do you remember the name of your video?
I don't know. It was right after I had shoulder surgery, so I know that I wasn't able to do it really well, which was kind of the point, I think.
Yeah.
You know, I was having to – I just came out of the shoulder surgery, so I was trying to rebuild that strength. I'm trying to see here.
But there's a ton of exercises you can do if you can't afford –
strength training for perfect – form in front bow shoulder. It's on Knock On Archery, the Knock On Archery YouTube channel. But it's the name if you want to look at it.
And by the way, that's also an awesome channel for instruction. You want to learn some stuff about archery. And I think that might be one of the things I'd seen from you before I ever met you too, is a bunch of little instructional videos that you had put out on the proper way to use releases, on a bunch of different things.
That's what I do. I teach.
That's what he does, folks.
I teach stuff.
And I know this sounds crazy, but we're going to end this podcast. Dude, it's only an hour and 45 minutes. Dude, you only did one podcast. Listen, I'll be back. Just relax. If we tag out tomorrow, maybe John and I will do a fight companion. Ooh. How about that, you fucks? Huh? So that's a big if. I mean, who knows if we tag out. And so this one, I'm gonna I'll email this to young Jamie, and hopefully he'll get this up pronto, and you guys will get it tomorrow. So that's it for now. You can check out John's Instagram page. It's Knock On TV. The YouTube channel, Knock on Archery, and all the episodes are up also of your TV show.
Yep. That's all for free on Knock on Archery as well.
There you go, ladies and gentlemen. And if you're interested, you're like, man, I need a hobby. Pick up archery, goddammit. And I wish there was a place near me that was a place that taught. You know, it's hard. It's hard to find a good archery school. And, I mean, we're talking about that today, about what archery clubs are like in England or in Europe, is that they're like country clubs.
Yep.
Where, you know, people go and, like, the way people go to play golf, people go to do archery and, you know, they appreciate it as a discipline.
Yeah, they have memberships and full bars in there. And
beautiful facilities.
Yeah, all kinds of cool stuff. Yeah, for sure.
Anyway. We're exhausted, folks. We've been doing nothing but waiting all day and getting up early.
Yeah, Joe's trying to have a little R&R here.
Yes.
And we're giving you guys an hour and 45 minutes podcast.
But that's it.
Our eyes are sagging.
It must end now.
That's it.
Because tomorrow we got to drop the hammer. So thanks for tuning in, everybody. Next week, I'm back to regularly scheduled podcast. I got a podcast with the great Dave Rubin, and I think that is on, that's on Monday. Then Tuesday, we're doing the big Election Day End of the World podcast live from the Comedy Store with Doug Stanhope, Bill Burr, Bert Kreischer, a bunch of other people, too. I think Joey Diaz is coming in, Tom Rhodes. Bert Kreischer's on the podcast on Wednesday, and then the next week I got a lot too. Next week I got Shannon the Cannon Briggs. Let's go, champ! He'll be on the 14th. Yeah, that's right, fuckers. Graham Hancock and Reynaldo Carlson on the 15th. I got a lot of shit going on, folks. So even though I'm kind of here, I'm here for myself. What about us, man? Sometimes I gotta do shit for me. That way, it's more interesting when I do shit for you. Okay? I'm living life, goddammit. I suggest you do the same. Thanks for tuning in. I appreciate you, folks. And big kiss. Thanks for tuning into the podcast, folks. Thanks to John Dudley for letting me use his equipment. And thanks to Diff Eyewear. Diff Eyewear, stylish handmade sunglasses, ridiculously cheap. Made with high-end materials. They're awesome. And for each pair of sunglasses you buy, Diff Eyewear will give a pair of reading glasses to someone in need. Try it, you folks. Do good. Buy smarter. Be Diff. That's what their logo is. That's not me. D-I-F-F. Go to diffeyewear.com/Rogan right now to get 15% off your purchase. That's diffeyewear.com/Rogan to get 15% off. diffeyewear.com/Rogan. Yeah, baby. We're also brought to you by Casper. Awesome mattresses, ridiculously low prices, and incredible risk-free trial and return policy. You can try it for 100 days. What more do you want, goddammit? Go to casper.com/Joe. Use the promo code Joe at checkout. Terms and conditions may apply, but you can save $50. $50 by going to casper.com/Joe. All right, folks, that's it. We're diggity, diggity done. So, see you next week. Bye. Love ya. Hugs. Hugs for you all.